So welcome to the Center for Autism Colloquium. My name is Jonathan Moreno. So this colloquium actually is the first of two appearances that Wolf is going to make. Tomorrow at noon, he'll be with a presumably somewhat smaller group in the seminar room. And we very much encourage those of you who are around tomorrow at noon to join us as well. So I'm going to do a little formal introduction for Wolf. And then we'll let him go for about 50 minutes to an hour, and then we'll have time for discussion. So Wolf Schmidt is the historian at the University of Kent in Canterbury. He is the first person I thought of to bring the pen when I got here 4 years ago, and we've been trying to work this out in our respective calendars for the last several years. I think Wolf is the most interesting historian of medicine working right now, and certainly the most interesting historian of medicine who's working on issues that are relevant to bioethics. We first met 7 or 8 years ago. I think I'd read something, and I wrote to Ulf, and we started a correspondence, and then we met when he was working in Washington doing some research, became good friends, and have remained very close ever since. His work, I think, is, as I've said to a number of people, in trying to be saying, I think, completely fascinating. His graduate work, his dissertation, we would call it here, at Oxford, was one in which he actually had to, and it's another complicated story he could tell you, trace down some medical films, euthanasia training films for doctors that have never been discussed by scholars. And he found them in an archive in Munich, was it?
Right? Göttingen.
Göttingen. Another complicated story, how he manages to worm his way into the oddest places. Being a native German and German speaker helps, of course. His next book was called Justice at Nuremberg, which is about the Nazi doctor's trial, seen particularly through the eyes of Leo Alexander, who was a German-Jewish neurologist who was the principal expert for the prosecution of the in the Nazi doctor's trial. Highly recommended. His most recent book is Karl Brandt, the Nazi Doctor, and I think people heard me a couple of weeks ago in the class mention the fact that Brandt was not only the first defendant in the trial, but also, in my mind, in many ways, the most interesting. And he was a member of Hitler's inner circle, spent a lot of time at the Wolf's Lair with Hitler and his whole retinue during the war, and had almost a filial relationship with Hitler. Nobody had done the work that Wolf did, pioneering work, to get the documents, the papers, the diaries, letters from Karl Brandt's son, which is another story in itself, that he was able to get to Brandt's son, who's also, as it happens, a surgeon, and whose name is Karl A. Brandt. The A stands for Adolf. Still living, is that it?
Yes.
Yes. So, critically exciting for me to help here at Penn. The talk he's going to give tonight is out of his current work on, as you see, on the sort of the history of the British chemical weapons program. No one else has dug into that history, that we know about what happened during the war to some extent, but not what happened before the war. So great pleasure to have Wolf here, and he'll talk, and then we'll be able to have some discussion.
Well, thank you very much, Jonathan, and thank you. I would like to thank Arthur Kaplan and the Center for Bioethics for inviting me here today. It's a great pleasure and a greater honor. And thank you for believing that it sometimes helps to be a German. I had a very warm welcome here in Philadelphia. You see, when you do arrive from Europe, and you are German with a British passport, there's always a certain degree of nervousness when you enter border control. And you're not quite sure what's going to await you. But there's always one thing I always tell myself when I do arrive in America, that I should tell the truth and nothing but the truth. So that was my approach I took in Philadelphia on Saturday. And when I was called up, I said, good day. And he said, how are you? So I said, yeah, I'm fine. I'm perfectly fine, hoping that this moment would pass. And he said, what are you doing in America? And I said, I'm giving two papers, hoping he wouldn't inquire any further. At that point, I had no knowledge that we are having National Education Week. So he said,
it's very short.
They didn't know either. Yeah, it's done. We do it in a day.
So he said, what's your paper on? I said, chemical warfare since the First World War. And he says, oh, that's very interesting. But chemical warfare has always existed. And I said, but yeah, but not since the First World War in a mass and systematic fashion. So here I was already arguing with the border control. So then he says, and what's the title of your second paper?
Tomorrow noon.
And I said, Nazi medicine. And I thought, this is not going well. I might not give my two papers. And he said, oh, that's very interesting. Have a good day. And I thought, this is really kind. This was the best welcome I've ever had. So anyway, last week, what I'm going to talk today is looking at this history. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about some of the narratives we have in Britain at the moment. Last week really saw big celebrations in the United Kingdom, celebrating the 70th anniversary of the Battle of Britain. Really, on almost all news channels and commentators, you know, were falling over themselves in praising the enormous courage of UK fighter pilots who defended Western democracy against Nazi tyranny. A couple of miles south from where I live, there is a large, huge memorial. This is a propeller actually carved into a hillside. Each of these blades is 38 meters wide. So there's this massive memorial in the area where I live. And next to it, there are Churchill's immortal words, never in the field of human conflict was so much owed by so many to so few. This is the kind of line which is repeated all over the news channels in Britain, you know, giving themselves a kind of courageous narrative. Interestingly, this year's celebrations coincided with the state visit by Pope Benedict XVI, which added yet another dimension to what is an increasingly sophisticated narrative which appropriates and in many ways perpetuates Britain's moral superiority during the war and indeed thereafter, including the Cold War period. Historians and other experts tend to see the Second World War as a fight between good and evil, a war in which Britain stood in the way of a murderous, atheist regime which had no regard for ethical values or the conducts of war, or the rules of war, if you want to say so. Okay. Well, there's also a less well-publicized and a less heroic side to this war, and one which I'm going to look at today, which had a long-term legacy. Britain, for one, had one of the largest, one of the most sophisticated, and one of the most deadliest chemical warfare programs in the world, and it was prepared and ready to use it. Under threat from German invasion, Britain's leadership, and foremost among them Churchill himself, cared very little about the 1925 Geneva Protocol prohibiting the use of chemical weapons in times of war. I'm going to show you a couple of pictures now, just to give you a kind of image from the kind of celebrations we had and how that actually relates to that. You see, these are the kind of photographs and images which are, you know, sent around journalists and newspaper commentators. You know, the Britain's boys fighting the Nazi tyranny. Here, actually, they had a mascot, you know, as well, and very sort of the proud Britain's fighter pilot who actually won the war. A home guard on the lookout for German airplanes. This is another interesting picture. London's population during the Blitz, you know, cowering. These were actually, they would stay there during the Blitz, and later these kind of images were captured by artists such as Henry Moore. So this is the kind of narrative which is increasingly gaining hold. Again, destructions of London. You know, this is what people remember and are being passing on to the next generation. And obviously, that is very closely linked with Churchill himself. What is interesting, in one of my archival visits to the Churchill College in Cambridge, I wanted to look at some of the papers relating to chemical warfare. And they were all listed in the catalogue, but I couldn't see any of them. And there were three different categories why one couldn't see them. I thought it was just interesting, you know, when it comes to those kind of issues, you realise this is still very, very sensitive when it is linked to personalities who have that kind of iconic status in Britain. Again, these were the kind of poster campaigns which were circulated around Hitler will send no warning, so always carry your gas mask. Again, those kind of images are quite well known. A gas mask exercise, Britain again, you know, started to prepare from very early on. This is 1941. You know, there were different types of gas masks. This is the kind of defensive side of this during the Second World War. You had women operators. You know, this, if you think about it nowadays, this is what they were actually preparing for, you know, to run a society under gas attack. It is quite astonishing and quite horrific. This is an interesting image I found in the Imperial War Museum. These are actually Royal Air Force armourers who are wearing anti-gas equipment while they were preparing to arm one of the Spitfire planes for chemical warfare attack. So there you get a slightly different nuance already. This is offensive chemical warfare. Britain was just, they were not just waiting for the Germans to attack, they were also preparing for offensive chemical warfare. And my last picture is of Winston Churchill here. Interestingly, he himself is wearing a gas mask, actually. So this is Churchill preparing for German attack. What is interesting, though, and again, this will bring my history here onto the offensive side. Churchill pressed his chiefs of staff to examine the feasibility and strategic benefits of using chemical weapons against Nazi Germany. For him, ethical or political considerations had no place to play in a war which killed women, children, and civilians indiscriminately in large-scale bombing raids. Mustard gas and phosgene were Churchill's chemical weapons of choice as attack weapons to cause maximum casualties and mayhem deep in the German heartland, but also as weapons which could legitimately be employed to defend Britain's beaches, ports and industries. And again, that is, I think, a narrative which is not well publicised. And some of these documents are gradually being, you know, declassified. In his retrospective assessment, he said, the Germans would have used terror, and we were prepared to go all the length. In 1944, he told his chiefs of staff, and I quote, it may be several weeks or even months before I shall ask you to drench Germany with poison gas. And if we do it, let us do it 100%. In the meanwhile, I want the matter studied in cold blood by sensible people and not by that particular set of psalm-singing uniformed defeatist which one runs across now here, now there. I shall, of course, have to square Uncle Joe and the President, but you need not to bring this into your consideration at the present time. Churchill considered it to be absurd to worry about the morality on this topic, unquote, since all parties had used chemical weapons in the First World War. Whereas the bombing of large cities had been regarded as a war crime, it was now done on a daily basis, he argued. Attempting to downplay any moral concerns of his senior military advisers, he noted, quote, it is simply a question of fashion, as she does between long and short skirt for women, unquote. So this is the leader of Britain talking about chemical warfare. Now, anyone looking at this history will recognize Britain's peculiar ambiguity in being one of the leading powers which supported efforts by the League of Nations and others to ban chemical weapons, particularly in the interwar period, and at the same time, and in total secret, established a vast program which saw the testing of highly toxic chemical agents on animals and humans for offensive and defensive purposes. And today I want to return to the origins of this program, reconstruct the decision-making processes among experts and medical scientists, their social and professional background, and the evolving strategies, as well as double standards, which helped to justify the development of outlawed chemical weapons. Now, for the Germans, it had been little more than a military experiment. It's often forgotten that, you know, for the Germans, they didn't quite know what they actually had when they first released chlorine in 1915. Yet for thousands of Allied soldiers, it was a painful reminder that modern chemical warfare had begun. In April, on the 22nd of April 1915, near the Belgian town of Ypres, German pioneers released 160 tons of pressurized liquid chlorine from 6,000 steel cylinders along a four-mile front. Within minutes, the cloud had enveloped tens of thousands of Allied soldiers. Utterly disoriented, coughing and choking, blinded, frightened, and overcome with violent sickness, they buried their faces in the mud or ran to escape the trenches. And we have very powerful, quite moving letters still available in the Imperial War Museum where soldiers actually write home and describe this very first chemical warfare attack in modern history. Allied propaganda estimated that 5,000 soldiers had been killed and 10,000 had been wounded, although these numbers are generally accepted to have been somewhat exaggerated. It's very difficult in terms of statistics to pin that down, but we're looking at a serious mass casualty, certainly, among soldiers. Whatever really the exact casualty number, witness accounts confirm that Allied troops had been exposed to one of the first weapons of mass destruction, which killed men slowly and painfully from within, rather than wounding them on the outside. For experts, however, such as Fritz Haber, the German chemist from the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute in Berlin, who had developed some of these weapons, it was a more humane weapon. When in 1919 he was awarded the Nobel Prize for Chemistry, believe it or not, he remarked, quote, "In no future war will the military be able to ignore poison gas. It is a higher form of killing," unquote. So that was the German chemist developing these new forms of weaponry. Many, however, tended to disagree. So this is not just something which started after the war. This started right after the first attack. There was a sense that the Germans had gone too far. From the moment chemical weapons entered the stage of armed conflict, advocates of the just war doctrines campaigned for an international enforced legal ban on these types of weapons. Chemical weapons, they argued, violated the requirement of non-combatant immunity because they killed and injured children, women, and the elderly indiscriminately, because you couldn't concentrate where the gas would flow. And interestingly, very often Allied soldiers later, when they would attack German soldiers, would be killed by their own gas because the gas would flow back. So it was a very difficult weapon actually to use, and that obviously created huge problems. What's more, however, German intentions had been all but cynical. And I'm going to, hopefully you stay with me, but it is actually for the whole story, it is important to understand some of the legal context here and how the Germans actually tried to outmaneuver international law as it was understood at the time. To sideline international law, they had specifically used steel cylinders for the release of the gas, and I'm going to explain why. Since 1899, so since the turn of the century, the Hague Convention respecting the laws and customs of war actually banned certain types of warfare, and those included aerial bombardment, this is what Churchill was actually referring to, chemical warfare, and hollow point bullets. A separate document called the Hague Declaration Concerning Asphyxiating Gases specifically outlawed the use of poison gas as a means of warfare. And I'm going to quote a sentence from this document by, quote, abstaining from the use of projectiles, the sole object, language becomes very important here, the sole object of which is the diffusion of asphyxiating or deleterious gases. And the Germans had spotted this, the people who had drafted this document had used the terms the sole object of, and you will see in a moment how they outmaneuvered this. The use of non-lethal irritants, the employment of gas through means other than by using projectiles, and the use of gas-filled, yet shrapnel-causing bombs were actually, by international law, not covered. In the event, the German army was less concerned about the inherent legality or morality of chemical warfare, but about semantics. Whereas the use of gas-filled projectiles was against international law, Germany considered the use of poison gas released from cylinders to be permissible. And if you look at the letter of the law, it actually was. That is the problem here. The Allies, however, described it as an act of inhumanity, which violated, quote, all codes of civilized human behavior. At the same time, and it shows that they were actually aware of these finer issues of law, the Prime Minister told King George, quote, as the gases are apparently stored in and drawn from cylinders and not projectiles, the employment of them is perhaps not an infraction of the literal terms of the Hague Convention. So here you had a real problem. The Germans had found a loophole in the international legal covenant of the time, and the Brits were now faced with huge public pressure. Given that Germany was widely perceived of having violated the spirit of the declaration, however, and with pressure mounting to retaliate, such legal sophistry had little truck with the British public. Within days, after graphic accounts of gas casualties had been published in the British media, and if you know the British media, your Americans are very, very civilized when it comes to British media. There's no holds bar. Yeah, anti-German sentiment had reached fever pitch. In Germany, meanwhile, gas war was portrayed as a modern weapon, which was not only lawful, but more humane. It's something when we think about chemical warfare, we don't actually think in those kind of terms, and that was actually a debate which mattered at the time, that some believe that this could be a more humane form of weapon. A week later, after the first mass attack on 7th of May, the sinking of the Lusitania by a German U-boat, which killed over 1,000 civilians, including American citizens, caused further outrage and turned public opinion firmly against Germany. So public opinion plays quite a significant role in these discussions. By portraying Germany as an inhuman enemy and German soldiers as barbaric criminals, hell-bent on committing atrocities against civilians by means of poison gas and submarine warfare. It's interesting, the two are actually linked further in those international documents. Submarine warfare and chemical warfare are very closely related as war crimes at the time. Allied officials actually managed to bring the United States into the conflict and justify, in the eyes of the public at least, Britain's retaliatory measures. Germany's gas attack then initiated a European-wide chemical arms race on an unprecedented scale. I'm not going into figures here, but you believe me, it is the biggest chemical onslaught we see. And if you look at the amounts being used later of mustard gas, this really surpassed anything which had been there. And it was a warfare in which there was, quote, no time to worry about ethics. Moreover, by using the newly developed Stokes mortar, which was a kind of pipe stuck into the ground, a kind of precursor of the rocket launcher, which the British had developed, and this new mortar had the sole purpose of delivering chemical projectiles into and behind enemy lines, Britain actually had become the first nation which contravened the literal terms of the Hague Convention and thus international law. At the end of 1915, the government established a large-scale chemical warfare testing ground, which became known as Porton Down. And some of you may have heard about that in the news, and I'm going to talk about that a little more. It rapidly expanded to incorporate administrative headquarters, laboratories, munition depots, open-air testing station, and an animal farm. Really a place teeming with military and service personnel and civilian scientists. What is interesting about Porton Down is that people actually experts would start to work across disciplinary boundaries, what we would nowadays call interdisciplinary work. And they really did that on the ground. So you had physiologists, chemists, pathologists, meteorologists, all working together to understand the complexity of chemical warfare and to turn it into a usable weapon. I'm going to show you briefly a couple of pictures. There's one of the headquarter buildings, which was created in 1918, shortly after the end of the war. An image of one of the huts in which some of the research was being conducted. A brief image from the First World War, in which there was actually an Ypres where the Allies used phosgene and mustard gas to an extreme extent against the German army. And I'm going to show you in a moment some of those scientists who actually were also involved in some of the research. Now, important scientists were tasked with developing known organic and inorganic compounds into the most deadly gases possible. That was their brief. Don't waste any time. Just, if you can develop anything new, which is highly toxic, we want to know and we want to ensure that we can actually use it as a warfare agent. In December 1915, the Germans used phosgene for the first time, an almost colorless and odorless gas, 18 times more toxic than chlorine, which when inhaled caused serious lung damage and death. Retaliating in June 1916, the Allies employed phosgene with devastating effect during the Battle of the Somme. So what you see is, they discover something, throw it at the enemy, they copy it, throw it back. So it's that kind of thing which goes on throughout the war. Realizing...
Did the Germans did the same release that time?
Sorry?
Did the Germans did the same kind of free air release?
The information about the...
So they just released it from the canisters, they didn't use it.
I see. No. Once basically the British had used the mortars, then all doves were off. So there was no concern about international law. Realizing that Allied respirators offered improved protection, German scientists developed ever more lethal agents which attacked the body now from the outside. Dichloroethyl sulfide, or mustard gas as it became known, because of its garlicky, mustard-like smell, was largely absorbed through the skin, causing severe burn and blisters within a couple of hours, and I'm going to spare you images of that. I know there are lots of doctors here and medical people who can stand these much better than I can, but we're going to talk history today. If inhaled, it could cause serious inflammation of the lungs, followed by a slow and painful death from asphyxiation. As the what was called the king of war gases, mustard gas stood at the forefront of Britain's research until the Second World War, when it was overtaken by nerve agents. But up until 1945, different types of mustard gas was where the British researchers were very, very good at. So it's not just one mustard gas, they had different forms. They had liquid mustard gas and so forth, vaporized mustard gas. You know, you name it, they developed different types for different situations. Porton's foundation was intricately connected with a generation of scientists, and I'm going to just present you three of them, or two, who were driven by a deep-seated desire for professional advancement and social prestige. In the interwar period and thereafter, the old Portonians, as they were called, formed a closely knit group of scientists with very close links to the British military. So even after the war, when the war was over, they continued to have their connections with the British military and were again readily available when the Second World War broke out. So there is a huge continuity here, which we can trace in terms of personnel. And that is actually something which is very important. It was this generation of military men and civilian researchers for whom the experience of the Great War and of tens of thousands of gassed soldiers marked a watershed in their determination to prepare the country for chemical warfare. They wanted to protect soldiers and the civilians and supply the military with the best possible means and methods to retaliate if it ever would become necessary. And just showing you a couple of pictures here, Joseph Barcroft was one of the physiologists at Porton who had a huge influence on research. Charles Arthur Lovett Evans, you can see the date when he dies, 1968, he actually dies at Porton. You know, that's the kind of continuity here we're looking at. The guy had he was living at Porton in the end. So from 1915 to 68, you had people who had experienced all major events. He's actually there during the 1950s when Madison dies. So that we have these kind of personalities who are in Britain's chemical warfare research throughout the years. And one of the reasons some of you may remember the case of David Kelly, who committed suicide a couple of years ago, which sparked a lot of sensational stories in the news. One of the reasons why the British newspaper found out who the man actually was behind the leak was because it's such a small group of scientists. We're talking about 25 to 35 top scientists. So you basically go down the list of 35 people, and they basically what the British journalists did, they found someone in the Ministry of Defense, and they just ran through these 35 names, and from name 30-28, they got a yes. So that's how
you better give them the context. Kelly, tell them the Kelly problem.
Maybe later.
Part of the Blair thing.
Sorry? Yeah, obviously that was part of the Iraq War story. Yeah. But there's a bigger story here. But what the main point I'm going to make here is it's a pretty exclusive, pretty small group of experts, what we're looking here. And they have their kind of connections. The networks are being formed in the First World War. This is not Second World War stuff. This is really early stuff. Clearly affected by the international climate, Porton suffered a crisis of legitimacy. This is post-First World War now. Questions were now being asked about Porton's annual cost to the taxpayer. In March 1922, the government insisted that it would, quote, failing in its duty if it failed to take possible steps which might be necessary to protect the forces of the Crown and the inhabitants of the country against gas attacks in times of war. So what we see very early on, defensive preparedness becomes the mode of justifying continued research in that field. Unbeknown to the public, the cabinet had already given the go-ahead to expedite chemical warfare research, since, quote, the safety of the empire could not be left to chance, unquote. To discover new warfare agents and means of treatments, much of Porton's work involved the testing of chemicals on animals and humans. Yet this work also increased the pressure to justify what they were actually doing there at Porton Down in Wiltshire. Although the pre-war anti-vivisectionist movement, and some of you probably know anti-vivisectionism in Britain actually had a pre-war history that was actually quite strong, and it had raised public awareness to animal research, tests with animals, many of them lethal, were seen as vitally important for Porton's research. They had their own animal farm, but that was obviously something which caught the attention of the public and which was not particularly popular. In 1923, the Under Secretary for War told Parliament that Porton had used, quote, 66 cats, 48 goats, 118 guinea pigs, 148 mice, 23 monkeys, 139 rabbits, and 209 rats in gas poison experiments. Attempting to dispel public concern, he remarked, quote, none of the experiments had consisted in dropping bombs containing poisoned gas among the animals. They were destroyed as soon as the object of the experiment had been attained, unquote. And I'm going to show you a brief table which I prepared. Between 1921, oh sorry, that's the picture of some of the scientists. Between 1921 and 1937, so really almost the interwar period, Porton carried out a total of 7,777 experiments on animals, of which 5,374 were killed. This is the table. The blue ones are the total numbers, and the red ones are the numbers of animals killed. What is interesting of this in this table, which I created, you see a general, very general, slight decline going on here. And this decline has its origin around 1925. Again, you know, the 1925 Geneva Protocol. So it does have, you could, you know, suggest there is some indication here that animal research, which is publicly sensitive, you know, dogs, for example, animal research with dogs were off limits, yeah? Horses, again, very complicated. But any other research, you know, you see that Porton starts to become increasingly sensitive to that kind of research. However, compared to 450,000 animal experiments in 1930 alone in Britain, Porton's animal program was rather small scale. But it attracted all the more attention for its association with secret military research, and it's still very much an issue for animal rights groups in Britain today when they have articles that Porton again used, exploded some pigs, for example, in some chemical warfare experiment. So you have those kind of news stories, you know, they are going on to this very day. Alarmed by these tests, animal rights groups alleged that Porton's research contravened the Cruelty of Animal Act from 1876. So again, you know, the law actually plays a role in these kind of public debates. And again, what is essential to understand is Britain starts to argue its case if they have to, that they say we need it to defend ourselves. Porton attracted further notice, public notice, when it was disclosed that the cost of the establishment to the taxpayer had more than doubled in the mid-1920s, expenditure which raised concerns after the world had been plunged into a world economic crisis. So again, you know, those kind of external factors we have to take into consideration for a place like that. You know, once money is short, you know, even institutions like Porton Down will be scrutinised, you know, whether that is actually money worth spent. Following Britain's ratification of the Geneva Protocol in 1930, they didn't sign this until 5 years later, so they took 5 years to make up their mind. Some politicians advocated, well, you're laughing, but United States took until 1974, so so actually Britain wasn't too bad on that one. Following Britain's ratification, some politicians advocated the closure of this establishment. In a climate of economic austerity in which chemical warfare had been publicly condemned, concerns for the rights of animals also drew attention to human experiments, which Porton was conducting as well. And what was quite clear that these experiments with humans carried the risks of injury, both physical and mental, and they were quite aware of that, short and long-term discomfort, disability, or death. Again, for the time being, and this is 1930, the government holds the line, we need to be prepared to defend the shores of the land if necessary. We need what they would call a defensive chemical warfare capability. On a bilateral level, Britain and the US now join forces in developing offensive and defensive chemical warfare resources through the sharing of information and material. Britain's scientists, for example, established close links with Edgewood Arsenal, which is the establishment in the United States which conducts similar research since the end of the First World War. So what we really see is that these kind of early connections, that what one could call them, one could say a kind of bilateral system and later tripartite with Canada, that this was critical in establishing a kind of network of these allied chemical scientists. Yet unresolved questions about the legitimacy of chemical warfare turned intelligence sharing between Britain and the United States into quite a sensitive issue. By assigning the highest security classification to anything to do with chemical warfare, and by avoiding the publication of details which could inform other countries about the work undertaken, Britain wanted to ensure that its expanding chemical warfare program would not become public knowledge. So in the 1920s, they actually are having a kind of twin-track strategy. You know, we are supporting the disarmament program by the League of Nations very strongly, very publicly, and at the same time, and in secret, developing a very large program and sharing these information with the United States. In a confidential letter from July 1924, Atkinson, the assistant military attaché at the American Embassy in London, told the head of the Chemical Warfare Service here in the United States that the British authorities were generally happy with the free exchange of chemical warfare information, provided there was an agreement, and that was an informal agreement, which restricted information to only those two countries. So the idea was, we give you all our stuff, but you make sure you don't pass it on, because the difficulty was, once you pass it on, other countries might know what the Brits were actually up to. Whereas Britain was, quote, going ahead with the work with as little publicity as possible, unquote, Atkinson noted, there was some concern that the extent of the work might be revealed through bilateral cooperation with the United States, and that they were really concerned about that. When it is understood that Great Britain is doing as much, if not more, than we are in chemical warfare, I'm sure it will be appreciated that it is of greatest importance that we exercise such precautions as she desires. So America was playing absolute ball, whatever the Brits wanted, because they were so far ahead of this kind of stuff. They understood how this weapon worked, and they had the scientists actually to back they had the science to back this up. Internationally, however, the subject of chemical warfare was openly discussed. Although the League of Nations almost unanimously portrayed chemical warfare as unethical and contrary to the rule of law, expert opinion was heavily divided. And once you actually look at that, you know, what do military scientists and some of the people in charge, what are they actually thinking? Again, a somewhat more blurred picture emerges. Whereas some saw it as an inhumane terror weapon which affected civilians and entire communities indiscriminately, others were convinced that it was, quote, the most powerful and the most humane method of warfare ever invented. And this, these are not some just some crackpots who are saying this. These are actually quite distinguished expert scientists who are making these views heard. One of these advocates was a man called John B.S. Haldin, a biochemist from Cambridge University, who in 1925 published his tract, Callimachus, A Defense in Chemical Warfare. That was the title, little tract. Haldin was convinced that chemical warfare was more humane than conventional weapons. Wounds caused by artillery shells were apparently, quote, more distressing than the effects suffered from gas. His call for greater investment into civil defense measures, interestingly, also revealed underlying racial prejudices and social stereotypes. According to this man, Haldin, research by the United States Army on the susceptibility of the human skin to different agents had apparently shown that 80% of, quote, Negroes were resistant to mustard gas compared to 20% of, quote, white men. It should be possible, he remarked, and I quote, to obtain colored troops who would all be resistant to mustard gas blistering in concentrations harmful to most white men. Enough resistant whites are available to officer them, unquote. So this is the kind of British expert chemist speaking from Cambridge, 1925. And these are people with pretty, with considerable influence as far as the views on this, so they shouldn't be just discounted. In addressing the relationship between science and ethics, he stated that all applications of science can be abused, but none perhaps is always evil, and many, like mustard gas, when we have got over our first not very rational objection to them, turn out to be, on the whole, good. If it is right for me to fight my enemy with a sword, it is right for me to fight him with mustard gas. If the one is wrong, so is the other, unquote. So again, might be something we want to, you know, come back to. Not unlike many who have misrepresented or underestimated the power of chemical weapons, and you know, it is a utilitarian argument he's doing. Haldin argued that chemical agents killed or permanently injured fewer men than conventional weapons. That was his main point. Irrespective of such voices, however, international pressure by the League of Nations, and you know, we often sort of slag off the League of Nations or United Nations nowadays, but actually, interestingly, they brought some things together in that period, and we shouldn't discount those. Pressure by the League of Nations to disqualify chemical warfare as a legitimate instrument of war continued throughout the 1920s. Although the Geneva Protocol outlawed the employment of chemical weapons, it failed in establishing an international verification and enforcement system and exposed deep-seated disagreements over disarmament. So again, many historians, when they look at this document, they look at the flaws, but they don't actually understand that there was also a considerable amount was actually accomplished. Whereas the United States was opposed to prohibiting the use of tear gas in war on the grounds that it was also used against civilians during peacetime, more often than not in civil riots in the United States, and refused to ratify, as I said, the protocol until 1975, French and British reservations to retaliate in kind limited the protocol to what we would call a non-first use agreement. Basically, you know, we won't use it first, but if you use it, we reserve the right to retaliate in kind. That was the position Britain left it in 1913. Notwithstanding these qualifications, however, In Geneva, the groundswell of public opinion against chemical warfare merged with high politics to form a powerful declaration of intent by the leading nations of the world to ban chemical and biological weapons once and for all. The product of well-managed propaganda, one could say, surely, aimed at committing the world to such an ambitious undertaking, but with the added effect, and that is interesting, of keeping the practice of places in places like Portendown in relatively well-defined boundaries. So these kind of international agreements, they filter down and they keep the scientists in check, at least as long as there is peace. To reflect Britain's commitment, the Chemical Warfare Committee was now renamed into Chemical Defence Committee. The changes in nomenclature changed little, if anything. Porton, like before, continued to carry out research on offensive chemical weapons technologies, and obviously they had to take into account these political sensitivities. Questions relating to chemical warfare now routinely surfaced as part of the World Armament Conference, which under the chairmanship of the former British Foreign Secretary Arthur Henderson opened in Geneva in 1932. So you have a real attempt by the international community in the late 1920s, early 1930s, to outlaw these weapons and disarm individual countries. But problematic, again, what we see here is Germany, again, as a player in these political negotiations. The overall negotiations were beset by disagreements over what actually constituted defensive and offensive weapons. That's something which has never gone away. So, it's very complicated, and obviously there are a lot of blurred boundaries which can be used and abused. And obviously Germany's belligerent posturing at that point already makes those negotiations extremely difficult. By the time Britain finally tabled a draft convention, 2 months after Hitler had come to power, it was clear that Europe, if not the world, was faced with an extraordinarily brutal, outwardly aggressive military dictatorship which had absolutely no intentions of settling international disputes by peaceful means. Now, in the context of a European-wide rearmament program which preceded the Second World War, issues relating to chemical warfare now were absorbed into issues of national security and defense. So that's where you really see how this merges. The countries are preparing themselves for what might happen. Almost all European governments employed the threat of chemical weapons as a vehicle to argue for improved civil defense measures. So it becomes a propaganda tool, actually, to push certain policies through. Whereas Soviet citizens received anti-gas drills, the British public was exposed to exaggerated reports about the power of chemical weapons. So, some of the possibility what these weapons could do was intentionally exaggerated. One estimate predicted that all citizens in central London would be killed after a large bomb had been dropped onto Piccadilly Circus. Nothing of that sort would have been possible at that time, technically. Sufficiently alarmed, however, by these international tensions, Britain launched a large-scale civil defence program which included the production of millions of gas masks. By 1937, over 5 million respirators were reported to be in storage. Following the notorious Munich Agreement in 1938 and Hitler's invasion of what was left of Czechoslovakia in March 1939, the government distributed over 30 million respirators. Here was an aggressor who clearly warranted the mobilization of all resources in preparation for a chemical attack. And again, you saw some of the earlier images. I'll just give you some more. They were really preparing for an all-out war. These are airmen clerks working with gas masks. mothers and baby wearing gas masks during gas preparations in the Second World War. They had some for dogs, for horses, for everything what you can think of. Another drill in Britain here, the war at home, adults and children try out their gas masks. Even nurses had to learn how to wear them. So this is, you know, is society, you know, bracing themselves of what might happen. And just a picture here from Portendown in 1940 as the Battle of Britain is about to begin. Research on chemical warfare now accelerated at all levels. Porton became an integral part of Britain's civil defence planning with access to military intelligence and hardware. An RAF special duty flight was put on standby to study the effects of airborne gas attacks. Porton's work included the design of respirators, detector and decontamination devices, filtration units for ships, for example, methods to prevent toxic gas from infiltrating the London Underground, impregnated garments, or the testing of ointments. So a huge spectrum of research they were involved in. To assist the Royal Air Force in assessing wind conditions on the ground, for example, or the Royal Navy in battleship protection, Porton conducted research on smoke. So smoke was another huge area of research, both toxic smoke and smoke curtains, which they produced. So I'm winding up in a moment. Offensive work involved ground mustard gas bombs to contaminate whole areas, gas-filled rockets, rocket launchers, gas spraying devices, or substitute agents, so-called pseudo-gases, to mislead the enemy. Above all, Porton conducted thousands of human experiments. In addition to retrospectively justifying their work and their expansion, and silencing for the time being those critical to the establishment, tests at Porton and elsewhere provided the British military with a realistic assessment about the effectiveness of offensive chemical weapons, information which was largely withheld from the British public during the Second World War. And I leave it at that. Thank you.
Good. Thank you. So even though it does get a little noisy when the air conditioning's on, I think we better put it on, otherwise we'll have our own gas experiment, unconsented. So you could probably open that up and push a button.
It's quite warm, isn't it? Or is it just me?
No. It's history. History is hot. So actually, Art and Ulf and I were talking about the fact that in bioethics, we are really bad at doing historical context. It's as though it just sort of started with the Belmont Report, or with the founding of the Hastings Center, or when, you know, Art and I were born. It's going to end at the end of that, but anyway. So we need to think, I think, as a community, more about how to teach history of medicine, history of science, as part of bioethics. Because I think without context, everything that Ulf has done creates a context, has spoken about tonight, up to the Madison death, the sarin gas experiment, and the human experiments that took place even after, and for quite a considerable period of time, as his other work explains, after the Second World War, during the Cold War. So without that context, very rich context, I don't think you really understand what's going on.
And what we wouldn't understand, then, really, is that some of the scientists who are then there when Madison is being killed in the mid-1950s, we just met them today. These are the people who are actually there in the 1950s. And so what I thought, really, you have to go back to some of these origins and understand that kind of broader network and how actually Britain's chemical warfare community evolved. I think there is obviously much more to talk about. You know, one of the connections with the United States, Edward Arsenal, was mentioned briefly, for example, but there is a huge history here in terms of collaboration going on, and later with Canada as well, which was established in 1940. But I'm sure there are some people who have some questions.
I'll just let you field questions. As you like.
You're talking about how there were a fair number of people who were in support of chemical weapons as humane or whatever else. Where were discussions like that coming down? Were they in the academic literature? Were they classified? Were they in media?
Oh, that's a very good point. I think there are mainly two areas where these are being voiced. One is within the academic field, and Haldane is an, a kind of established academic in Cambridge who produces this tract. I haven't followed up, say, the publication numbers, for example, but it does have an impact. It actually is in a number of libraries, and it was read at the time. He was very distinguished, and he was very connected to the British establishment. His father, also called John Haldane, had also been a chemist and a physiologist, and he had been the first person who was sent to France to identify what gas the Germans had been used. So there are these family connections within the British medical establishment and the scientific establishment. So I think it's a voice which shouldn't be discounted. This is not just what some loner who's putting out these views. The others are, I think one could say, that they are coming from the military. Both those who had been had played a role during the First World War, for example, those who had led the British Chemical Warfare Service during the First World War, they think that chemical warfare is a legitimate weapon. That was their brief, and they put those kind of views out after the First World War. There are other military figures, like General Peyton March here in the United States, who had himself witnessed how children have been gassed during the First World War, and for him, this is completely unethical. This is, goes against, he was a defender of the just war doctrine, you know, that you can't just use these kind of weapons indiscriminately against women and children. So they are even within the military, they are dividing voices, but your point is right. It's mainly within those kind of groups of people in which those kind of voices are being raised.
What's the connection between the chemists or military personnel working in this time period and the rise of the British chemical industry, which is pretty busy at this time?
Excellent, excellent point. I couldn't dwell on these kind of greater connection, but you're absolutely right. From the moment Horton is being established and from the moment Britain decides to prepare themselves and create a serious retaliatory potential and capability, the industry is part of that. What Britain established was a kind of unified chemical warfare committee, which was above the scientists on the ground. They kept the kind of overview, and that was a committee which was later copied by the Americans, because it was it had representative of the industry on the board. So they were there, actually, and that made the British administration and the decision-making process very efficient, because you had all the boys there. It was a gentleman club. They had connections through their education and through their professional lives, which basically, if they wanted to get something done, you had the industry people here, you had the people who could do the science, you had the manufacturers on board. So that was quite an efficient system, and it was that system was later modeled both in Canada and in the Edward Arsenal. And so when it came to what one could call joint operations in the First World War, the British show the way forward, how to do it, and they do it very, very efficiently. And you could see, well, how did they come up with this? But you know, I think one would have to go back to how Britain ruled the world as colonials. You know, you use as few men as you can to rule lots of other people.
Haldane convinced the scientists and the public.
Sorry?
Haldane convinced the scientific world and the public that penetrating wounds were more damaging than gas war.
He didn't. There's a short answer of it. Yeah? Within, as I'm saying, he was, when he came up with his track, so to speak, the climate was certainly not right for him, even though he was an established chemist at the time. But the overall public and international opinion was against him. And the League of Nations play a big role, who are pushing this issue at least since 1922. There's the Washington Agreement here in 1923, and in 1925 you actually have the Geneva Convention, which does have an impact. It is being discussed in Parliament. So in a sense, he's going against the flow. There are some people who agree with him, expert opinion, but he doesn't get any truck with any serious politicians who feel that this is the kind of, it's not the kind of climate at that point. You still, mid-1920s is still the climate in which people hope, you know, to have a kind of international system in place which can prevent those kind of wars from ever happening again. and other many countries have to actually cope with huge inflation in Germany and later with the economic crisis. So it's not at that point an issue. It becomes later in the mid-1930s when they actually want to go back into a much more offensive stance that they can say, we told you so, we need chemical weapons because Hitler is on the horizon. So it was a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy. Then they could retrospectively justify what they had done. But while they were doing it, they had a bit of a problem.
I put it down, were the only human volunteers in the military, were they also prisoners or other populations?
Excellent question. Maybe I should have explained that a little bit more. But at the beginning, you had many of the scientists themselves were actually volunteers for some of the experiments, and they were pretty dangerous. Some of them, and later on they were mostly service personnel. So you didn't have experiments with prisoners. And again, the kind of tests we're looking at in the 1950s, we're looking at RAF personnel, and we're looking at a recruitment system, which in a sense where people from the military volunteer for those kind of tests. And what is interesting is you have a history of people who start to volunteer in the 1920s and throughout the 1930s, who volunteer for mustard gas experiments in the 1940s, including Australia and other places, and you probably have heard those kind of where experiments went pretty wrong. And you have then the next generation who heard that from their parents, you know, what they knew was mustard gas. So when in the 1950s tests are being made with nerve gas, the word gas for service personnel meant mustard gas. So, and that's where the problem in the linguistic problems arose. Most of the volunteers are veterans I've spoken to, and you've probably known some of them as well. They had no idea that what they were actually being experimented on were nerve gas experiments and not mustard gas. And there's a world of difference, and that was not explained to them. And see, what you see is, in a sense, that the procedures, and that was something which later became very critical in the judicial review in Britain, which we saw recently. What you see is that the procedures for conducting the experiments, including how to recruit them and the notices to give them, as far as voluntary consent is concerned, the procedures were those from the Second World War and the 1930s. So the procedures had not caught up with a new agent which was so much more lethal and so much more dangerous and had such a high risk and was so difficult to control, and the procedures hadn't caught up with that.
Just on the volunteer point, in the early 1950s when the Pentagon was trying to figure out how to get volunteers to be in ABC, atomic bombs, chemical weapons experiments, they appreciated that it was very cumbersome to ask for individuals, time consuming. So they were interested that the British had units that volunteered. And how exactly units volunteered, of course, was a question that wasn't analyzed very carefully. But they liked the fact that you get a whole unit to volunteer, that would solve the manpower problem. And that was a British concept.
Just on that note, so in a sense there was an established system. You know, when they had their tripartite conference meeting in the 1950s, early 1950s, they would, you know, outsource certain experiments to Porton because they knew Porton was doing it.
Right.
And if certain experiments they needed, say for skin tests, Porton had a subsidiary station in India, for example, so they would do them there. So Porton had a network of stations. Depending what skin, unquote, you needed, they could do that, and they had the kind of experienced scientists on the ground, and they would report back to all. They would share those information. So for the Americans, that was the best way to go forward. You know, not risk. You know. Nonetheless, they did their own stuff as well.
We managed to find some.
Sorry, I've forgotten you.
You mentioned it sounds to me as though they put a lot of resources toward developing potentially defensive measures.
Definitely.
Against these weapons.
Definitely.
But I couldn't help but think of people who would speak of defensive measures against atomic weapons, which in practice was an impossible idea. And I just wonder, I guess my first question would be, did anyone really believe that these measures would be effective in a large-scale attack? Mm-hmm. And then secondly, was the human experimentation primarily on research into defensive measures, or was it equally kind of balanced between developing offense?
I think your second question you may have to repeat, but I tried to answer your first question. I think they did believe that this could help. The main point I was trying to make was that chemical weapons in the run-up to the Second World War becomes as much as a propaganda tool in moving civil defense measures generally forward. You had to get that through Parliament and through the channels and find the resources to do that. And the actual tests which Horton was doing at home, also in Canada, in Australia, they actually suggested that chemical weapons was not an attractive proposition for an aggressor, and that if they would be used, they actually wouldn't cause that kind of mass casualty. So the kind of, when you look at it from the kind of technology available, and Horton was top of the league at the time, so they had a pretty good knowledge of it, but at the same time, it was a very, you know, pragmatic use of it in the run-up to the war to get the population mobilized. So you know, they certainly didn't want to forego that one. What was your second?
The second was just that I was curious. I assume they appealed to the volunteers' sense of patriotism or the sense of the urgency to develop particularly defensive measures to protect
Absolutely.
Their fellow citizens. And was that primarily what they kind of appealed to in getting people to agree to this, or was it just?
That sounds like a very American question. I think we talk money. So I think a lot of it was the incentive was money, for many of the soldiers, and was time off so you could visit your girlfriend. So it's really those. It's also later after the Second World War. It's those little things. It's the couple of shillings more, and later on you may get you're helping your country, but it's an add-on. Not in the foreground of many. They obviously understood from their parents later on that there had been that danger and it would be good. But when you talk to some of the veterans, it's actually interesting how they say why they volunteered. You know, they wanted, many of them called it a jolly. So they thought they had a good time. And later on, even in the 1960s, Hort wanted to portray itself like a summer camp, where you could have a week off and could have a good time. They had films with a bar and women really nice. So when you see that and you actually know some of the history behind it, you think, well, it's not quite the correct representation of what's going on.
Interestingly, the Seventh-day Adventist Church, you heard about this, who had soldiers at Frederick, at Fort Detrick, put out a brochure around the same time in which they showed guys on the exercycle and at the pool table and so forth in between the biological weapons experiments. So they did want to show in both cases that, apart from the motivation for volunteering, that it was a light atmosphere, it was a convivial sort of atmosphere.
Sorry, I forgot.
It's okay. This might relate more to Justice at Nuremberg. Can you speak a little bit to the privilege of victory and the double standards? And I don't want to obviously go down the road of what ifs, but the kind of justification that gives you after the fact once
okay.
The conflict is over, per se.
Are you saying Second World War? Or?
Second World
War,
yeah.
Are you thinking in sort of victor's justice?
Of course.
Kind of line, and that they were in the running?
And then in terms of how then you go and frame retroactively these experiments that were done, and that privilege that it gives you.
That is a very good point. And then, in a sense, you know, as I said, this is work in progress. I look, sort of, my story here is 15 to 39, or this end of the Second World War. That's something I'm going to write next, that kind of issue. But a kind of short answer to that. One of the things which really, really caught the British, as one of the directors once said, there was only one point when they discovered that the Germans had developed nerve agents. He said that was the only time where we were caught with our trousers down. And it was something they had not expected. It was a total shock. Here you have the most advanced chemical warfare establishment in the world, has a huge network, has intelligence access, is sharing information with the Americans, has enormous resources during the Second World War, and they had absolutely no clue that the Germans had developed nerve agents, which is, in terms of weaponry, is comparing a rifle with the atomic bomb. It's really, you have a huge jump in toxicity here suddenly, And what they were then doing was, on the one hand, you're absolutely right, there needed to be a retrospective justification, once A, for the failure to discover it, and B, to understand it. You know, how did the Germans do it? So what they were basically saying, now we know that the Germans had it, we need to test it. So they are starting test series on nerve agents. So everything post 45 in Porton Down, almost everything, is nerve agents, and later VX, which is even more lethal. And so you see a huge increase in nerve agent trials, and the problem was that they didn't know what they were dealing with. They actually didn't know the toxicity of the chemical compounds. The very first experiment we know of they were doing was on two human volunteers and two rabbits. And so they put this stuff on the two rabbits and the two volunteers, and the rabbits died within 30 seconds, and then they brushed it off from the volunteers, really nervous.
What year was that?
This is 1946. Yeah. And so you have then, suddenly there is a stop in experiments for 5 years, until, or 3 years. In 1949 they restart the program, but you can see they were suddenly dabbling with something which was so toxic and so unpredictable, and the difficulty in actually understanding individual idiosyncrasies of humans, because sometimes people, for example, who are quite thin and can have very different results. If your skin layer is particularly thin, it is absorbed differently. So the problems in understanding these individual variations in human was hugely complex, and the science was hugely difficult. And by the early 1950s, they didn't quite understand what they were actually doing. And the main point we were making later in the Madison case was that they were actually pushing the envelope really far. They wanted to know what it takes. And I just quote from one document which we used in that court case, which was very difficult for the government to dispute, because we had found a handwritten document which described the test in which Madison was being killed later on, and that the object of that experiment, before it was being done, and I quote, was to discover the dosage of GB, which is sarin, GD, which is zoman, which is even more toxic, and GF, which is cyclosarin, which, when applied to the clothes or bare skin of men, would cause incapacitation or death. So here you have the object of the experiment is to push your limit. You want to know what, you know, CD50 is. The lethal dose
was 50 of half of the subject.
Half of the, exactly. So that was what they wanted to know. And you know, they were, you know, pushing, you know, playing with fire. They knew that they had a couple of accidents before. They had in April 1953 they had someone falling into a coma. So, I mean, if someone falls into a coma, you know you're dealing not with sugar, yeah? So you're dealing with something which is very, very dangerous. But they did not stop the line of experiments. So what you're seeing here is they wanted to know what is needed to kill a man. And in the end, they killed someone, which had huge repercussions for them ever since. If that gives you just an indication.
But it's also like, once you open Pandora's box, you can't just pretend that it doesn't exist. Now we have to keep pushing.
And the other point is, you have an establishment with its own dynamics. You know, once you have an institution, you have dynamics which actually are at times difficult to control. And I mean by control that the politicians themselves had difficulty in actually stopping important scientists to do certain work. So what we see is that once Madison dies, for example, there is an instruction to stop all experiments until the investigation is done. But the scientists want to complete their test series. Mm-hmm. And what we found out in the actual experimental books, that they continued the line of experiments. And you know, when we discovered that, the coroner went absolutely ballistic and said, why did the police not actually reveal that in court? And they said, we had forgotten to turn the page of the experimental book to realize that the experiments had actually carried on. And obviously there was a huge kerfuffle, if you think imagine it. So you have scientists, not, I'm not saying on the loose, but you have scientists, you know, as you say, once they want to know, they want to know.
Sorry. One more question, then we have to break, I'm afraid.
Yeah, I find it very interesting that despite the obviously apparent interest that Britain had in developing defensive and then offensive chemical warfare, I find it very interesting that they did get caught with their trousers down. And I'm just wondering what your thoughts are as to how that could have occurred. I mean, how did they not carry it one step further? How did they not say to themselves, well, we want to be, you know, offensive to the point where, you know, as they said with the atom bomb, you know, one strike is all it takes.
I think that another very good question. I think there are two points I think one could say. One is that Germany's paranoia and security obsession in Nazi Germany was absolutely extreme. The Germans, to actually create certain nerve agents, they had given individual compounds code names. And those code names, again, were classified on transit. So it was a hugely complicated system which they had produced, where individual people in the end didn't actually know what substances they were in the end. So it was so complicated that very, very few people had an understanding of what they were actually dealing with in terms of the substances, because the substances where the name the substance was given was not the actual name. That was it. So that was one of the reasons why the Germans managed to keep it secret for so long. And obviously Britain had very little access to that kind of intelligence, because most of the production of nerve agents was actually done in some of the eastern territories, or close to the eastern territories, away from bombing raids and away from a possibility of getting intelligence. So that's one of the reasons. Very sophisticated, in a way, quite awkward system of camouflaging that kind of, because for them it was a kind of a backup. The Germans assumed that the British would know. The Germans went on the, even though they kept it secret, they assumed that they would obviously know it. The other reason is that, that it was a kind of chance discovery of someone who was doing research on pesticides. And even though within the literature, discussions on these kind of phosphorus compounds have been done, they never took that next step, as you say, that they realized that it could actually create an even more lethal agent. It was very unstable at the beginning, and the chemists managed then to create more stable. The very first one was Tabun, which was quite difficult to employ. They later then produced sarin, which was much more stable, much more lethal. And the very last one in 1944 was called Zoman, which is the deadliest chemical agent, one of the most deadliest chemical agents we know on Earth. But those are the kind of reasons why the British really were found. But when they discovered it, all hell broke loose.
Yeah.
It was hugely embarrassing.
So maybe I'll just end with one last question for you on the Madison case. And I hope you all know by now that Ronald Madison was the RAF flight engineer who died at 20 years old in the sarin gas experiment in Petrie. When you went back at the request of the court to look at the documents, and both, as you know, organized the historical documents, what surprised you the most? You already talked about the fact they continued. Perhaps that was the most surprising in that case. What was the second most surprising thing you discovered in the course of putting that material together?
That's a good one.
What surprised me the most? I'm not sure historians are surprised.
Not British ones, though.
Yeah, sense of irony. Yeah.
I was certainly surprised about the onslaught from the Ministry of Defence against me.
Well, say something about that.
I mean, that was very surprising. I have to say, you do a viva when you do your PhD in British university. You're being grilled for an hour and a half, and you think this was the worst thing I've ever had. and then you go into the witness box as an expert, and you're being grilled by three lawyers for 2 days, and then you know what's really terrible. What I really found surprising was the way they wanted to set me up.
Hmm.
You know, that they would construct a kind of general argument, and as a historian, it's very difficult, it's an issue of balance. assessment, and you could say, well, generally speaking, I could agree that's it's a good point. And then next day they would use that in order to say, well, you said yesterday that was general, that was a, you know, and now actually we're coming to the specific. And I thought that was a sort of such a cheap shot with a jury there on such a sensitive matter where someone had died. And you have to be very quick-witted to understand what they were doing in a language which is not your own. And I thought that was interesting.
Well, we have some current and future litigators in the room.
Well,
who will be using historians, perhaps, in their own practices, so it's an important point.
But the best moment, actually, in the whole, for me, the best moment came when we ran through a classified document in camera, and we ran through the different pages, and she would, you know, can you look at this, can you look at that, really quickly in order to disorient me. And she would say, well, here we see, you know, the Americans are talking about Porton, and they are saying we used Porton as a model, and so they used the word model. And then she goes to something else, and then in the end she says, so do you agree, yeah, that Porton was actually, they could use it as a model? And it was just one of those moments.
In a normative sense.
I said, well, but the word model can have two different meanings.
Yeah.
It can mean model as an ideal, but it can also mean the model as just the model in which you want to use it. And then I said, in this case, it's the latter meaning of the word in this particular context. And the judge sort of turned around to the lawyers from the Ministry of Defence and said, see, Miss Mackay, that's the problem of English.
So I'll tell you the most interesting thing to me, and then we can stop, was what you told me about the Defense Department's role in some of the documents, right? That we need to just say that in a sentence or two.
Sorry, which
well, the Rumsfeld's folks who came over, because there was a question about
the story how we got the documents. You know, the coroner has access obviously to British documents, and the difficulty with the, I talked about security classifications. So, and we're looking at pretty sensitive stuff, and we're looking at, it was 2003, America had just invaded Iraq,
yeah.
I think. So it was, you know, not the best of times to have a chemical warfare trial in Britain. and to air these kind of issues in public and actually tell the world that America and Britain were pretty advanced and big in terms of this kind of stuff. And it was interesting that you know, we suddenly received letters from U.S. Counterintelligence that we would, they would make sure that we, I don't know, not know our names if we ever said anything about this kind of stuff in public, that we were allowed to read these documents, but we were not allowed to discuss them at all. There would be a police officer standing next to us. We would not be allowed to make any copies. So I went and took a pencil and started to copy everything. Until I was called in front of the coroner and he said, that was not the idea. So it was a kind of very British way of dealing with this problem, you know. In the end, you know, we wrote it all down, you know. When you're a historian, a bit like a scientist, you know, it's something, you know, you feel you have to, you know, and you have to tell the people at some point. So the whole thing is not much less sensitive nowadays, and I just feel that, you know, there's still sensitive issues here involved, but I still think this has to be made public. That's my view.
All right, thank you so much.
Thank you.
So tomorrow noon, again, Ulf will be talking about the Nazi doctors trial and work on Grant and whatever else you want to hear about that. And those of you who signed up for dinner, just want you, you can either collect here or we're going to go right over to the White Dog and meet you there, and they should be taking for us. Thanks.
So, what I'm going to do is I'm going to walk you over to the restaurant.
Was that okay?
Yeah, it was fantastic. I love this stuff.
So now, should I stop this here?
Oh yeah, I guess so. We can just pull it out of the wall. And just,
so I'll get cut. Yeah, that's fine. Just pull it out.
Yeah.
So
sorry for speaking too long.
No, no, it's perfect. I'll get Katra and give her the envelope. No, no, I want you to sit with the kids and have a drink and relax and talk. And then I'll pick her up and let her drop off.